I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. Bob, for setting this up and getting to share the stage with Richard St. John as well as Barb, and thanks for my lovely wife being able to be here. I actually am playing hooky from the restaurant tonight, so I'll get into some restaurant poems in a little bit, but I figured I would just kind of start off with a couple of music poems, kind of fitting the theme of Barb's poems. So this first one is kind of an ekphrastic poem off of a Sonny Rollins, his album called The Bridge. You can't be in heaven and earth at the same time. That's a quote from a Sonny Rollins interview. You can't be in heaven and earth at the same time was how Sonny Rollins once described woodshedding on the Williamsburg, neighborly concern leaving him to practice on the bridge's deck, stretching his breath at all hours, until sturdy notes took bloom, strident enough to serenade cars changing lanes, the honking seasons turning his stage hiatus into years of playing for many weathered skies. Arriving on the heels of Ornette's new sound, Rollins declared his return with The Bridge, the last cassette I'd buy before dropping out of college. It's God Bless the Child, never failing to cue an image of my skinny pal, Stoner Bob, camped below that underpass near the jail. His rocky nook bearing tents, torn sleeping bags, and the tags of local wild-style legends. Bent, yard-high script, reading like a code of Krylon pastels. Then last week, a ragtag drumline jamming under a yellow span had me longing for the impossible, a brass-winged solo calling out far above us all. This next one was just from a drive that my wife and I had in Maine, that it was sort of strange coming across a blues club near Acadia National Park in Maine. Additional parking for Big Pete's blues wagon. In the glide-by scenery of June, one steel sign hangs to a heavy sag of chain stretched across cement-stuffed posts, its seven purple words glistening with wind-blown mist. Stuck on this drizzly drive down Route 3 with only pop and talk on the Reynolds radio, I glance at a place where summer trees once danced and swayed before the crowds gave out. Here, bands rode twanging delta grooves, gut bucket and gospel, into the call and response of soulful release, buckling hearts, rattling windows. Later on, blue notes would steam from a boss horn's bottomless bell until the walls flaked mojo and left memories now curled yellow, fingers keeping time, tapping a night away on wobbly, beer-sticky tables. Big Pete's locked doors and gravel lot wrung dry of its music. Gonna move into another newer poem. You know, I guess life's a bunch of learning opportunities, I suppose, and it was just kind of a scene that I kind of came across at an unfortunate funeral that I had to attend this summer. Ty. It's been 10 years since I was part of a wait staff, swapping those clip-on black bows for the wine-dyed straights a busser showed me how to bind. Even longer since my dad's passing, when I thought it was lucky having a red paisley number stashed with its four in hand already in place. Before his father's funeral, Cousin Anthony asked an uncle for help with his purple tie, dangling undone from hands as calloused as his old man's once were, skins grown thick on a sewage plant gig that never called for a half Windsor. Standing face to face, the mustached elder draped that taper over his nephew's neck, pulled the wide end longer, cinching ribbon into right, looped one end over the other until the tangle took shape. A final tug made the knot sit tight on the collar. A fine tuning got it hanging, belt high and plumb. And one more newer one that, a little... little shout out for my own father who passed away about 11 years ago. He was very, very slow to anger, so I don't want anyone to think that he was a psychopath. Slugger. On the narrow streets where I grew up, a southpaw wave or headlight flash was all the harmony it took for drivers to settle right of way. Until a traffic slight and a beer buzz set Dad off on a beeline to bash our bald neighbor's head, spitting nails and waving my dusty Louisville slugger. When Mom's cries won't turn him back, I'm sent to block the walkway, a teen trying to pry those 30 ounces of hard gray aluminum from his machinist hands coiled around its sticky black-taped handle. This is the bat that smacked a Little League triple. Years later, a faded Ford blocking my driveway for days will set me off on a scramble to its roof, trying to smash this sedan as if it were 1,000 empty cans, a constellation of crescent dents left before a window gets shattered, my left hand bloodied. And after a hazy morning of lying to the cops, the heap gets towed, bits of safety glass twinkling my street for weeks, the barest reminder of a feeling, that summer fastball finding the sweet spotted barrel, my feet barely touching ground as I rounded first base. So I'm going to move into some of the poems in my my chapbook, Argot. For those of you that don't know, aren't familiar with the word argot, it means specialized language. Similar to what jazz musicians would use to talk about music, or people in the medical field, or people in the restaurant business. Jose at the Yum Yum Cafe. Jose stir fries a blistering wok of lo mein, an illegal cooking the Szechuan dish for sweatshirted undergrads who slurp their noodles through chopsticks while he works over blue-flamed burners in a steamy kitchen. The steady heat of gas stoves like a rippled current of manual days and long labor. Over a joint at my girl's apartment, he will share his broken English journey from a Costa Rican village to border crossing. For $1,000, he was smuggled in the back of aluminum U-Hauls. Jose has spent the brutal Houston summers landscaping beneath a heavy-handed sun, scrubbed dishes in 100 Chicago eateries, then came to Pittsburgh's gray shore of opportunity. Maybe his America is now a cold-blooded embrace or a soggy foot. Maybe it's a wink, a paycheck under the table, tenement rent deducted from a non-negotiable wage, one nation united in its willingness to give him a bite if only it can take its own bite back. Before I moved to New Orleans, Jose asked my help learning English. He wants to enroll in college. My time short, I give him a book of poems, Bukowski lifted from a bookstore in my baggy pants, thinking it will be a helpful and amusing way to learn the syntax of broken promises and understand a language of despair. But he already understands. So perhaps the pages will collect dust and needless folds among diasporas of Latin American dreams, that he will prefer to salsa dance on his rare time off. Maybe at the Cozumel on Tuesday nights, with its specials on Cuervo and Corona, and breathless partners spun into tops. This is the title poem, Argot. I suppose this one's kind of dedicated to my mom. Argot. In the sweaty restaurant kitchen, where I'll learn to cuss in Mexican, tattooed line cooks talk shit in voices nicked as the bone-white monkey bowls we stack and fill. They call the boss and picky customers chupacabra, goat sucker being the inside joke for every pain in the ass. Years ago, in a place once a mustard factory, I was a boy touring mom's latest food prep gig. A windowless world where the clam chowder paddled around in vats deep enough for me to stand. And I wore a paper hat, same as the mustached men in bloody aprons who cut up and kitted while they hacksawed T-bones from beef sides. Now I dig 12-hour grooves of full trays and spaghetti joints with family names. I keep ice bins full and counters clean, wondering at times if the routine has replaced the oxygen of my dream with a working life that takes what it wants, stealing my pen and handing me bad math on credit slips. On her days off, Mom wants to play Scrabble, but instead we talk about our fingers, how they've split into open-flowered nerves, stinging our bodies to the bulk of a weary self at the end of the day. Each of us searching for the phrase that captures what it is to feel at once both capable and small. A couple other shorter restaurant poems. Waiting for rain. Ice pails air dry on a stainless ledge while we servers, hungry and hungover, hustle for an always early lunch crowd of middle-aged kids escorting creased-cheeked women, wheeling their walkers white-knuckled. Small feet in canvas keds shuffle over leaf-print carpet like delicate wind-up toys, cogs and gears turning. We move like bees, table to table, keeping the coffee filled, clearing the dirty china, wary of their delicate bones. We try to tread lightly in heavy black shoes. To know this life as a parade of Sundays is to begin an education in a culture of demand, topping off the half-empty glasses of the dry-mouthed, as if the water pitcher we lug about the dining room is a full cloud and the thirsty must wait, like dry plants waiting for rain, their roots buried in sand. And this next restaurant poem was kind of a challenge Jan Beatty had given me to write a poem about this experience. So this is kind of what came out of it. Scraping away. Once when we were new, a plate of seafood crashed to the kitchen tiles and became the first scallops some of us had ever tried. Scraping away the broken to save the unscathed, we chewed briny mouthfuls of gritty sweet meat, swimming in a sniff of garlic and white wine, thinking nothing ever tasted so good. As that moment passed into sounds of clinking silverware and carrying on, while Perry Como sang overhead, imploring us to learn the mambo's to and fro, a lesson we'll soon take to humming. In a heaping world that needs us to believe we can be oceans, pushing waves toward a shoreline we can't see, the worn-down, far-off places of ourselves. I'm going to move into a couple of other things. I'm going to read a couple of other poems for my father, just to kind of mix things up a little bit. 13 Steps. For his last 6 years, my father geared each night for the climb upstairs by gulping swallows of air into his shallow lungs. The tether of oxygen was necessary armor against all 13 steps, against disappointment that stretched to the edge of his queen size, now more goal line than restful. Here he sat with the clock radio tuned to KDKA and waited to see if he would ever get comfortable again. Each humid July, I hauled the air conditioner up from the basement to his window frame. Under its awkward weight, I struggled not to gouge plaster divots from the walls, its sharp-pointed metal soon to be a humming box of Emerson Quiet Cool. My long feet plodded over older-than-me burnt orange carpet, laid over joist and squeaky floorboards. This stairwell was once my narrow playground, a lumpy slide, a fork. In recurrent dreams, I leap from the top, weightless, never reaching bottom. This next one is a poem for my old pickup truck that I got to drive my wife here. And so I always thought that my truck deserved a poem. So it's called Proper Maintenance. The red pickup is a listing heap with one tire like a bitten donut. Each crank of jack on pebbly driveway brings blood to my flayed knuckles. Heavy lug nuts make my shirt pockets sag. As wheel slides from axle, I battle gravity to a brief draw before dropping the metal rim on the grass. I'm sweating in sun of early April, bold strokes of black grease smearing my flannel and jeans. The decade-old truck contains a litany of repairs. Its underside rattles on left turns, tailpipe hacks at acceleration. Its glove box fills with papers, itemized bills detailing cost of procedures and GM parts. This is my inheritance, overseeing memories of my dad. We had beers at the Eagles Club, and later he drove me home. It was springtime, windows rolled down, the one time we rode in it together. I teach at a couple of universities, and I often teach a kind of a definition essay, which uses an object to give my students a sense of identity, something that's personal to them, and you know allows them to kind of write something a little bit autobiographical, I suppose. So I was kind of thinking about that a little bit whenever I was coming up with this poem. A ginkgo tree teaches me something about memory. Rooted to its sooty spit of land, stony and still, the ginkgo stands beside a boulevard of whispering full-speed cars, a living fossil shotgunning breath through the wet-lipped world. In class, I teach freshman writers the inanimate object is a trigger to pull on the past, to embrace detail while they capture the dead as a wedding band, a t-shirt, or the smell of an ant whose cheap perfume burned the throat, their fingers trying to touch all the ringed years under wrap, one long, dusty summer note. Now, watching a season change clothes amid the falling rain, I see how the ginkgo tree drops its yellow leaves, all at once, unlike our human loss in sudden autumn. Move on to of others. Let's see. This next poem is for the old Electric Banana, which is no longer there. It's now an Italian restaurant, apparently owned by the same people, though. Punk. I keep embarrassment in a stash, stacked and piled like yellowed news, in cracked plaster rooms, off behind the kitchen table of my mind. A place to visit my drunken faux pas, file away the fuck-ups, and feel bad about the time I hit an old woman in the mouth with a jar full of maraschino cherries. Sometimes I thumb through to that time when Leo and I were 16 and we sat parked for hours in front of the Electric Banana. A punk club will never go inside out of fear our night might end in a busted nose from a swirling mosh pit full of knees. Our missed chance to stomp and bleed on a sticky dance floor still jangles like loose change in a pocketful of sad attempts to fit in. But it's only after Leo's blonde hair is lost to glue and malt liquor in a botched attempt at dreadlocks, after he buzzed it close to the skull and we lose touch, that I'll come to know so well those minor threat cassettes that click in a dusty Delco tape deck while we watch the Iron City punks loiter about the banana's front door in their comfortable mohawks and effortless combat boots. Marooned and sober behind a foggy windshield, a lush hillside fails to take shape, and I find that, years later, I'm a self full of deeds undone, going places where so much is an idling Chevy with a paint job the color of contusion. This is kind of a Pittsburgh-y poem. It's a poem for the last Grateful Dead show that was one of the last Grateful Dead shows that was ever played, and it was kind of this past summer was apparently the last time the remaining members of the Grateful Dead will ever play. So I thought it deserved a poem. Section 620, June 30, 1995. From the upper decks of Three Rivers, poured onto Pittsburgh's north side as a multi-use stadium, circa 1970, a place with all the character of a concrete ashtray, imploded since we swayed that night away, thousands deep in the psychedelic darkness, moving among steep aisles and plastic yellow seats, lit and spun on LSD and K, while the Dead played, unknown to us all, one of their final shows, before Jerry Garcia could no longer rise to play another encore, and I forgot I was afraid of heights. Rain played metaphor as the second set began, the muggy air wet with synchronicity and improvisation. We stayed dry under overhanging roof and chewed on ice cubes, knowing convergence is something to behold. The sizzle of good vibe coming together amid astroturf and summer storm. Here there was no Ginsburg or Kesey, and I would never whirl like a dervish, trying hard to hold my head on straight, wishing earlier that blue June day among the asphalt parking lots, among the beer bottles, for the hunger of a constant moon, one that could hover and hold still time, before places and days like these are all gone. I'll just finish up with about three more poems. My sister absolutely hates this poem, but nevertheless. Bully. Although it was my sister who took the training wheels off my Schwinn, and sex ed came from a spongy copy of Penthouse stashed in the woods, it was Dad who first taught me to ball a fist, keep the thumb outside, and aim for the nose. He wasn't thinking of the punches I'd later land on Daryl's round head and Kool-Aid-stained mouth. Year after year, I'd dish out the same pounding each time he visited his aunt, our one-sided backyard brawls becoming less about his weak wiffle ball play than my need for our game to end in his cries. This is before I began to stare at the handicapped or whipped mom with a wire hanger, before I stoned stray cats and mistook cruelty for honesty when I asked my first girlfriend if the rumors of her being a whore were true. To say that I once prayed on the weak as if it were a rite of passage would be to wonder if Daryl still remembers how I taught him to spit blood and swear at the top of his lungs, learning at my hands how to give with all he had. This next one's for an old friend and for old times that I definitely kind of miss. Demetrius's glasses. All the girls on acid, sitting cross-legged on the carpet of his unfurnished bedroom, would try them on. Thick lenses with brown plastic frames. His glasses could amplify the best hallucinations. Demetrius moved from the Y to sleep in a house of misfits and stoners. Sometimes he would vanish. We all feared daylight back then, not looking much beyond months emptied of their useless laughter. In those days, we looked shady, dressed in yellow, pasta power t-shirts, busboys at Spaghetti Warehouse, smoking joints in alleys between double shifts. The passing dog walkers never said a word. We haven't hung out for years. It's hard to know what to say now that he's blind. I remember slipping on those glasses, their magnified blur. Remember feeling helpless the way he must feel in the dark and without them now. Just going to finish with, need to give a little shout out to my all the hardworking restaurant employees out there. This poem's called Curse. Waiting for steak and fries beneath this dining room's cold light, I look on as Angelita, the stocky Paiute waitress, hauls ales and elk burgers to tables of Germans, touring Utah parks on Beamer bikes. It took until senior year for me to balance a full tray of steaming chow, elbow wobbling until I learned to spread fingers wide, hoisting the fiberglass oval on the level plane of my palm, held steady above my right shoulder. And when the boss said to hustle, I wore a ready smile and worked without pause, buffing lipstick from wine glass rims, scooping up what was left behind, spoons and mugs half full of cold coffee, chicken bones and change, once a slimy denture. Delivering dumb calories to hungry mouths is to consider the flocks of fried fowl, the braised and broiled herds I've lugged three plates at a time on one of my skinny limbs, and to wonder if it's worth sharing with this hardworking woman how I measured out my tired body by the decade, one arm grown longer than the other. Thank you so much.